Welcome back to CM Property Digest, your trusted source for in-depth discussions on Africa's real estate and built environment. We delve into key trends shaping the sector, from sustainable development and urban innovation to construction and infrastructure, while highlighting the trailblazers driving change. Today, we are privileged to feature engineer Esther Segaro, a highly respected leader in Kenya's real estate and construction industry, and a registered engineer, both in Kenya and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Esther has a Bachelor in Civil Engineering from Moi University, an MBA from the University of Nairobi, and a Diploma in Sustainability from the Swedish Institute. As the immediate past president of Women in Real Estate, WIRE, Kenya, she has been at the forefront of advocating for gender inclusivity, professional growth, and policy-driven transformation in the built environment. With extensive experience in engineering, infrastructure development, and property investment, Engineer Segaro has played a pivotal role in shaping Kenya's real estate landscape. Under her leadership in 2023 to 2025, WIRE Kenya continued as a powerhouse for empowering women in real estate through mentorship programs, capacity-building initiatives, and strategic partnerships that enhance female representation across the sector. She has also been instrumental in influencing policies that foster sustainable urban development, equitable access to opportunities, and the integration of modern building technologies. Beyond her role at WIRE, Engineer Segaro is a progressive, passionate advocate for sustainable construction and infrastructure resilience in Kenya. She has contributed to national conversations on housing affordability, the adoption of smart cities, and the role of engineers and developers in addressing the country's growing urbanization challenges. Could you share your journey into engineering and project management? What inspired you to pursue this career, and what are some of the major challenges you faced along the way?
My interest in engineering started back in Lugulu Girls High School. Physics and chemistry were my favorite subjects back then, and I enjoyed all the physics experiments. Double physics class was my jam. I then applied for engineering to Moi University main campus. Initially on arrival, I was supposed to be in the electrical engineering class, but for most of the first week, my friends were in the civil engineering class, and so I made the change and went to the civil class the next week. The rest is history. On completion of my degree course, I worked in Nairobi for J.M. Kariuki Consultants, and although school gave me the theoretical knowledge, it was under the training of Engineer Kariuki that I became Esther the Engineer. I had opportunities to design, supervise, and manage. After which, I had a one-year stint with Sinohydro Corporation as a bridge engineer, followed by 5 years with a design and build company where I started the engineering department and also headed the construction department up to 2024. I then had another one-year stint with NBST Africa, being really a jack-of-all-trades on the Ngara revitalization project. Jack-of-all-trades because they were setting up and I got to involve myself with so much and learn so much from some of the best investment leads in the world while I did the engineering bits. Along the way, I attained my MBA, got a diploma in sustainability, and also took construction adjudication and construction management courses, which have all played a role in creating the engineer that I am today. I find that pay disparity has been my biggest challenge, but so many other challenges face women in the built environment. I was lucky that my biggest allies have been men who I have worked under. My mother took such a pivotal role to educate my sister and I, so I've had lots of job opportunities and had the opportunity to work on some award-winning projects in my 12 years of practice. However, as President Emeritus for WIRE, I have to lend my voice to the many challenges women have faced, are facing, and hopefully will not continue to face for much longer. The broken rung, that missing step in the success ladder for women, underrepresentation at all levels regardless of age and experience. McKinsey & Company in their 2024 reported that it would take another 48 years for Black women to achieve gender parity. Engineering and real estate have long been perceived as male-dominated fields. It is especially meaningful that this interview comes right before Women's Day, 8th March, so we are excited to know. As the president of Women in Real Estate Kenya, how has your journey shaped your perspective on gender diversity in the industry? What progress have you seen, and what challenges still remain for women in the industry? When I joined WIRE in 2017, there was only about 3% of professional representation for women in the Kenyan industry. We now stand at about 11%. In 2017, I did not think of the 2022 to 2025 scenario, where at least 5 associations in the built environment would be headed by women. It was unthinkable that the NCA chairperson would be female. Look at us now, and I have days where I am skeptical and just want to accept that the system was not developed for women to excel in the industry, and more so black women. Then I have more days where women like Florence Niole, Etta Madete, Mercy Okiri, QS Rachel Patience Molondo, my own peers, get it absolutely right, and I am convinced more than ever that it is completely possible.
As a leader in the field, how do you mentor and support young engineers, especially women? And what qualities do you believe are essential for success in the real estate industry?
I enjoy mentoring young women, and I have mentored at least 3 women every year since 2020. Confidence and self-belief. You must believe in yourself more than anyone else believes in you. Audaciousness. Then resilience. You will be hit from time to time. Get up and keep going. I have gotten more hits than wins. You would not know from just looking at me.
Could you walk us through one of your more prominent projects, the Startup Lions Project, and the impact it had on infrastructure development and the Turkana community?
The Startup Lions Project was my COVID project, a project I took on at the start of COVID in 2020. Built in Laropia in Turkana County, it was designed by Francis Keir Architects. I was fortunate enough at the time to carry out the engineering design and then was asked to head the construction. The architects were in Berlin and I was in Turkana with an A-team. Employed 100% community, worked with women and delivered a masterpiece that was very sustainable in many ways, including the community involvement. It took a lot of sweat from me as I was away from family the entire year, but I enjoyed the experience. Then I got to spend 1 week on site with Francis Keir. Just spectacular how he thinks through designs and design changes very methodically and prioritizing local manpower. We got to train more than 50 locals in construction, and that was invigorating. It was after Lorogio that I actually decided to serve on the WIRE board in 2021 as the registrar.
With growing concerns about environmental sustainability, do engineering projects align with sustainability goals? And how do you balance that with economic and social community factors?
Sustainability is so broad and no one size fits all. A lot of the times people think of sustainability as use less water, LED lights, rammed earth, the basics. Sustainability includes the economical, the social, governance and environmental. I took about 9 months to go through training on sustainability sponsored by the Swedish government under the Swedish Institute, and I learned that sustainability requires consensus and sustainability hates corruption. Sweden as a country relies a lot on timber and timber export for their economic growth. And so they have created that same vision and passed it down through generations that their forests remain sustainable and still accessible without illegal logging and whatnot. It is all very controlled. But that is Sweden.
What does it look like in Kenya to say we are sustainable? Should we build in clay? Or should we embrace other aspects of sustainability such as social equity and inclusion and healthy governance structures? I am not a fan of prescribing sustainability, as I have seen what's happening in the global north. I have experience with the Kenyan industry, attempting to copy the north, and ended up trading carbon. And I am currently in the Middle East, where the rate of construction in concrete is astonishing. But we are still working towards sustainable.
We have Kenyan environmental laws such as the Forest Act, which regulates tree cutting by requiring licenses. I would like to know how this affects the Championship for Mass Engineered Timber, MET. This examination could lead to a constructive dialogue on how to effectively harmonize sustainable practices with the laws that exist currently. What is your take on this? Use of mass engineered timber has never been about cutting down trees. Kenya's tree cover now stands at 12.13%, while forest cover is at 8.83%. In Sweden, they look at a circular forestry system. Trees are planted, harvested, and replanted systematically. For every tree cut, several more are planted. Plus, engineered timber really aims to utilize every part of the tree and thus reduces material waste.
Please elaborate to our listeners the direct benefits of having alternative materials like rammed earth and timber as primary building materials and how they can also be leveraged for an aesthetic finish.
Reduced energy is used in the production of timber and rammed earth and other environmentally sustainable material. Does that mean we will construct in rammed earth all the affordable housing? Understanding alternative material is about awareness, and then awareness and information will allow you to make informed choices to substitute or select differently when faced with a choice. Urban development in cities like Nairobi is increasingly focused on high-rise concrete structures, which contrasts with rural areas where timber construction is more common. This raises important questions about the sustainability and adaptability of urban planning. What constructive ideas do you think could address this trend? And are there any initiatives underway to promote a more balanced approach to development? There is limitations to different material, and as I mentioned earlier, one size will never fit all. Cities are dense and have different requirements, and the rural areas are more low-density built for individual families. I would challenge the professionals to come up with practices that fit our Kenyan scenario, where a majority of people will live and work in the city for economic reasons, and most aspire to retire in the more rural settings.
Looking ahead, what is your vision for the future of real estate in Kenya? And what advice would you give to young aspiring engineers and policymakers to drive positive change in the sector? How do you advise they navigate the industry to create meaningful impact?
For Kenya and Africa as a whole, sustainable growth depends on prioritizing key infrastructure areas such as transport networks, clean energy access, water and sanitation systems, affordable housing, and digital connectivity. These sectors not only drive economic development, but also improve quality of life and resilience to climate change. Public-private partnerships, PPPs, play a critical role by bringing in innovation, funding, and efficiency, while governments must create enabling environments through stable policies, transparent regulation, and incentives for green, inclusive development. With strategic collaboration and a focus on sustainability, Africa has the opportunity to leapfrog outdated models and build future-ready infrastructure that supports equitable and long-term growth.
Your journey is not only an interesting one, but an impactful one, so I must ask, what next for you, Esther?
I am currently in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, doing what I do best, unlearning, learning, creating change in my space, and continuing to ensure that I remain vocal within my space. I am also confident that women in real estate will continue to grow under the leadership of President Rachel Patience Mulondo, and that this is just a step towards bigger, better, and bolder.
Understanding the doctrine of an innocent purchaser for value. Insights from the case, Sehmi and another, via Tarabana Company Limited, and five others, petition number E033 of 2023. Article by Mercy Kirui. The concept of an innocent purchaser for value is important in property law. It protects buyers who purchase land in good faith, for a fair price, and without knowledge of any problems with the land's ownership. This protection is especially useful when there are disputes or fraud involving the land. In Kenya, this concept plays a crucial role in determining land ownership when multiple parties are involved. A recent case in the Kenyan Supreme Court, Hacharan Singh Sehmi and another Visa Tarabana Company Limited, and five others, petition number E033 of 2023, explains how this protection works and the kind of evidence buyers need to show they are innocent purchasers. The case overview. In this case, Hacharan Singh Sehmi and Jaswaran Sehmi were disputing the ownership of a piece of land that was registered under Tarabana Company Limited. They claimed they had bought the land legally and in good faith, without knowing of any issues with the title or ownership. They argued they were bona fide purchasers for value, meaning they purchased the land honestly and at a fair price. The case involved several other parties, including Tarabana Company Limited, Rospatec Limited, and government bodies like the Chief Land Registrar and the National Land Commission. The main issue for the court was whether the SEMIs had done enough to verify the land's title before purchasing it. What the law says. In Kenya, Section 26 of the Land Registration Act says that a title deed is proof of ownership. However, this can be challenged if someone can show that the title was obtained through fraud or mistakes in the legal process. For a buyer to be considered an innocent purchaser for value, they must meet three key requirements. Bought in good faith. The buyer must have purchased the land without knowing of any issues with the title. Did their homework. Due diligence. The buyer must have taken steps to confirm the title's validity, such as performing an official land search. No involvement in fraud. The buyer must not have been involved in any dishonest actions related to the land sale. The court's decision. The Supreme Court ruled that the SEMIs did not meet the requirements to be considered innocent purchasers for value. The court found that they had not shown enough proof of doing the necessary checks to confirm the title was valid. They could not provide evidence that they had conducted an official land search, which is an important step in confirming ownership. The court concluded that simply claiming good faith was not enough without supporting evidence. What this means for people buying land. The case highlights the following steps for anyone buying land. Get an official search certificate. Always get an official search to verify the seller's ownership. Check the title for problems. Ensure that the title is free from any legal disputes or claims before purchasing. Keep good records. Retain documents like contracts, receipts, and communications with the seller. Taking these steps helps protect buyers from potential legal issues and ensures that their property ownership is secure. Conclusion. The Supreme Court's ruling in this case clarifies that to be considered an innocent purchaser for value, a buyer must provide evidence of good faith and proper checks on the land's title. This decision reminds both buyers and sellers that land transactions should be handled with care and thoroughness to avoid future disputes over ownership. By following the law and taking these precautions, buyers can secure their property and avoid complications.
The Evolution of Construction Law in Kenya, Institutions and Procedures. Article by Joram Wangombe. I. Introduction. The Construction Law of Kenya regulates the construction industry and governs the legal aspects of infrastructure and development projects. It encompasses contract law, tort law, property law, environmental law, and administrative law as applied to the construction sector. Construction law has evolved over time through the enactment of new laws and the reform of outdated ones, aiming to establish and improve construction procedures, practices, standards, and the creation of oversight institutions. This evolution spans from the pre-colonial period, where rudimentary materials such as mud, stones, and sticks were used, to modern construction materials involving bricks, steel, and mortar. Second, historical background. Pre-colonial era. The Arabs and Portuguese, who had conquered parts of the Kenyan coast, introduced modernized construction methods that contributed to the development of coastal towns like Mombasa and Lamu. Inland, construction was basic, with settlements mainly for residential purposes. Land was communal rather than individually owned. Today, the old Arabian and Portuguese architecture has been designated as historical sites, protected by law to preserve these monuments as part of Kenya's heritage, colonial era. Kenya's construction industry took off in earnest from the coastal region, moving inland. Construction regulations were governed by British colonial ordinances and common law. Major projects, such as the Kenya-Uganda Railway, were government-driven, with limited legal regulation for local contractors or safety. The construction of administrative buildings and government housing relied heavily on ordinances that applied in England and India at that time. Employee safety and living conditions during the railway construction were also significant issues, partially addressed through ordinances such as the Public Health Act Cap 242, which regulated sanitation. Post-independence era, a 1963 to 1980s. Following independence, Kenya began formalizing its building codes with the introduction of the 1968 Building Code. The professionalization of various construction sector professions also began with the Architects and Quantity Surveyors Act, Cap. 525, and the Engineers Registration Act, Chapter 530, regulating professional standards. B. Liberalization and reforms, 90s to 2000s. Structural adjustment programs, SAPs, encouraged public-private partnerships, especially in infrastructure projects like road construction, contributing to the modern roads and highways we use today. This was supported by PPP contracts. The Kenya National Highways Authority, KENHA, Kenya Urban Roads Authority, KURA, and Kenya Rural Roads Authority, KRA, were established through the Kenya Roads Act of 2007. The Physical Planning Act, now repealed, provided guidance on land use and construction approvals. Dispute resolution became more professionalized with the introduction of arbitration via the Arbitration Act, 1995. Third Modern Construction Law Framework. Legislation, Role in Construction Law, Constitution of Kenya, 2010. Devolves land use and urban planning to counties, Article 66, 186, 4th Schedule. Environmental Management and Coordination Act, EMCA, Chapter 387, requires environmental impact assessments, EIA, for major construction. Physical and Land Use Planning Act, 2019, regulates development applications and county development control. Building Code 2023, replacing 1968 Code, sets safety, structural, and architectural standards. Public Procurement and Asset Disposal Act, 2015, governs construction contracts involving public entities. Occupational Safety and Health Act, OSHA, 2007, provides for worker safety during construction. Land Act, 2012, addresses land tenure, acquisition, and use for construction projects. National Construction Authority Act, Kapino Sabegusi Byugbi, establishes the NCA and its regulatory mandate. Architects and Quantity Surveyors Act, Chapter 525, regulates architectural and quantity surveying professionals. Engineers Act, 2011, regulates engineers and firms practicing engineering. Fourth, institutions involved in construction law. National Construction Authority, NCA, established under the National Construction Authority Act, 2011, the NCA is responsible for registering contractors and construction sites, monitoring compliance with construction standards, promoting capacity building and training in the sector. Board of Registration of Architects and Quantity Surveyors, BORAQS, regulates and registers architects and quantity surveyors. Engineers Board of Kenya, EBK, regulates engineering professionals and firms under the Engineers Act. National Environmental Management Authority, NEMA, enforces the Environment Management and Coordination Act, EMCA, and ensures compliance with environmental impact assessments, EIA, for construction projects. County governments issue development and building approvals, enforcing zoning, planning, and building control at the devolved level. Public Procurement Regulatory Authority, PPRA, monitors compliance with procurement processes for public construction projects. Fifth procedural framework. 1. Getting started. Make sure the land is properly registered under the Land Act. If you need to change its use or subdivide it, apply through your county physical planning office. Big projects may also need an EIA approved by NEMA. 2. Design and approvals. Submit your plans to the county government for permits and to the NCA to register the project. 3. Procurement. Public projects follow formal tendering under the Procurement Act. Private ones can use custom or standard contracts like FIDIC or JBCC. 4. Construction and supervision. Your contractor must be NCA licensed. The NCA, county inspectors, and OSHA officers will carry out site checks. 5. Completion. Once done, get a certificate of completion and an occupancy permit from the county. The NCA then closes the project. Sixth dispute resolution in construction law, mediation, promoted under the Court Annexed Mediation Rules, 2015, especially for commercial disputes. Arbitration, commonly used in construction disputes via FIDIC/KEBS contracts, governed by the Arbitration Act, 1995, and international norms, UNCITRAL. Institutions include Chartered Institute of Arbitrators, CIARB, Kenya, Nairobi Center for International Arbitration, NCIA. Adjudication, used in large projects for interim dispute resolution, especially under the FIDIC Red Book. Litigation, aggrieved parties file suits in the Environment and Land Court, ELC, or the Commercial and Tax Division of the High Court. Remedies include injunctions, specific performance, or damages. Seventh, challenges in construction law evolution. Overlapping regulatory functions, e.g., NCA versus county governments. Corruption in approval processes and procurement, exemplified by the Nairobi County Government Building Approval Bribery and Corruption Scandal in 2024. Weak enforcement of occupational safety standards. Delays in dispute resolution, non-compliance with professional registration requirements. Case law examples, Republic 4 Nairobi City County, 2020, EKLR. The court held that the county government must comply with physical planning requirements before approving developments. China Wu Yi v. Nairobi City Water and Sewerage Company Limited, 2022, EKLR. The court confirmed the use of arbitration for construction disputes under standard form contracts. Republic Vive Nema Ex Parte Sound Equipment, LTD, 2011, EKLR, emphasized the necessity of EIA compliance for commercial developments. Rehman v. Luha, Environment and Land Case 10 of 2016, 2022, KEELC 13714, KLR, 28 September, 2022, highlighted the importance of NEMA and NCA approvals before constructing additional units, establishing a management corporation, and issuing sectional titles. Recent developments and reforms. The Building Code of 2024 introduces modern engineering standards and green building measures. Amendments to the NCA Act aim to enhance enforcement and accountability. Digitization has led to the introduction of e-construction permitting systems in Nairobi and other counties. Conclusion: construction law in Kenya has evolved significantly, driven by infrastructural growth, legal reforms, and environmental concerns. Today, a multi-agency framework with strong statutory backing governs the sector, though challenges remain in enforcement, coordination, and dispute resolution efficiency. Ongoing reforms, including digitization and regulatory alignment, are expected to further professionalize and streamline construction law practices.
Shared assets, shared liabilities, Kenyan Matrimonial Property Law Principles article by Nalima Walubengo and Maureen Njenga. Introduction. Once people get married, the common norm is that now they are regarded as one, reflects a widely held social understanding of marriage as a union where individuals often see themselves and are seen by others as a singular entity. This notion frequently extends beyond emotional and social bonds to encompass economic aspects, implying a pooling of resources and a shared future. While this concept of becoming one captures the essence of shared lives and aspirations within marriage, the reality that is dissolved marital unions comes into play. How do parties legally separate and/or share the economic aspects accumulated in the course of the marriage? The Constitution of Kenya 2010, the Marriage Act 2014, and the Matrimonial Property Act 2013 guide us on the legal considerations to be had as parties mediate or legislate separation of their economic oneness. The legal implication, Article 45.3 of the Constitution of Kenya 2010 provides as follows. Parties to a marriage are entitled to equal rights at the time of the marriage, during the marriage, and at the dissolution of the marriage. The Court of Appeal in the case of Agnes Nanjala versus Jacob Petrus, Nicholas van der Goes, 2011, EKLR, held as follows. This article clearly gives both parties to a marriage equal right before, during, and after the marriage ends. It arguably extends to matrimonial property and is a constitutional statement of the principle that matrimonial property is shared 50%, 50% in the event that the marriage ends. Section 10 of the Matrimonial Property Act, 2013 provides as follows with regards to spousal liability. 1. Any liability incurred by a spouse before the marriage and relating to the property shall, after marriage, remain the liability of the spouse who incurred it. 2. Despite subsection 1, any liability that was reasonably and justifiably incurred shall, if the property becomes matrimonial property, be equally shared by the spouses, unless they otherwise agree. Third parties to a marriage shall share equally any A. liability incurred during the subsistence of the marriage for the benefit of the marriage, or B. reasonable and justifiable expense incurred for the benefit of the marriage. In the case of MWG versus DGW, 2021, EKLR, the court held as follows. The suit property had been utilized on the matrimonial home before the parties herein divorced. The applicant has now left the home. It cannot be fair that she continues to shoulder the burden of meeting the entire loan repayment. The property is registered in the joint names of the applicant and the respondent. In the circumstances, it is only fair and just that pending the final determination of this originating summons, the parties should equally bear the burden of meeting the loan repayments. Recently in Sem Vers 3, 2025, KEHC 4503, KLR, the Honourable Court in its ruling stated as follows. There is no reason why the applicant should be saddled with the mortgage repayments, yet both parties enjoy equal rights before, during and after the marriage. Conclusion. While the notion of shared liabilities in marriage might be met with apprehension, it's crucial to understand that the law upholds the principle of equitable responsibility for debts incurred during the marriage, mirroring the approach to shared assets. The legal framework recognizes that just as both spouses may benefit from assets acquired during the marriage, they also share the obligation for liabilities accrued during the union. Therefore, divorce does not absolve a party from their fair share of contributing towards the debts incurred, reinforcing the idea that the financial responsibilities undertaken within the marriage are a joint concern that persists even upon its dissolution. Tax considerations in real estate investments. Funding and Profit Extraction Strategies. Article by Wanjiku Kigwatha. Real estate investments demand meticulous tax planning, particularly when structuring funding and extracting profits. The choice between equity and debt financing carries distinct tax implications that can significantly impact returns. In Kenya, legislative changes such as the Finance Act 2018 and 2023 amendments have refined these considerations, making it essential for investors to align strategies with evolving regulations. Below we explore the tax implications of funding methods and profit extraction, offering insights for optimizing compliance and profitability. 1. Equity financing, dividends and shareholder distributions. Equity financing involves raising capital through shareholder investments, with profits distributed as dividends. While this approach avoids interest-related restrictions, it introduces specific tax obligations tied to shareholder residency and profit sources. A withholding tax on dividends. Dividends paid to shareholders are subject to withholding tax, WHT, with rates differing for residents and non-residents. Resident shareholders, 5% WHT on dividends received. Non-resident shareholders, 15% WHT on dividends. Exemptions. holding companies owning at least 12.5% of a subsidiary's shares are exempt from WHT, encouraging corporate structures that minimize tax leakage. B. Penalties on untaxed profit distributions. Distributing dividends from untaxed profits triggers a 30% penalty on the distributed amount. This rule ensures companies cannot bypass corporate tax obligations by prematurely extracting profits. Investors must verify that retained earnings are fully taxed before authorizing dividends. C. Expanded definition of dividends. The Finance Act, 2018, broadened the definition of dividends to include non-cash benefits, such as asset transfers to shareholders or related parties, e.g. land or housing units. For example, transferring property to a shareholder at below market value may be deemed a taxable dividend, subject to WHT. This measure closes loopholes used to indirectly extract profits. 2. Debt financing. Interest deductions and restrictions. Debt financing allows investors to deduct interest expenses, but Kenya's tax regime imposes limits to curb profit shifting. Key considerations include a limit on how much interest you can deduct from taxes. If you take out a loan, you can usually deduct the interest you pay from your taxable income. However, there's a cap. You can only deduct interest up to 30% of your earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, often shortened to EBITDA. This rule mainly applies to loans from outside the country, and it's meant to stop companies from using foreign loans to lower the amount of tax they owe in Kenya. B. 2023 Amendment, Resident Lender Exemption. The Finance Act, 2023, exempts interest paid to resident lenders from the 30% EBITDA cap, incentivizing local borrowing. However, loans from non-resident lenders remain subject to the 30% limit, requiring careful structuring of cross-border debt. C. Affordable housing exemption. Companies involved in government-approved affordable housing projects may bypass EBITDA restrictions upon approval from the Cabinet Secretary. This policy supports Kenya's housing goals by reducing financing costs for developers. D. Deemed interest provisions. For interest-free loans from non-residents, the Kenya Revenue Authority, KRA, imputes a deemed interest based on the prevailing 91-day Treasury bill rate, then subjecting the notional amount to 15% WHT. This ensures tax collection even on non-monetary benefits. E. Arm's length. Principal loans between related parties must adhere to market interest rates. The KRA may adjust non-compliant rates, leading to higher taxable income and penalties. When choosing how to finance a project, it's important to strike the right balance between debt and equity. Loans allow you to deduct interest payments from your taxes, but only up to a certain limit. On the other hand, using equity avoids these limits, though dividends paid to shareholders are taxable. A balanced mix of the two can help you get the most tax benefit while managing costs like withholding tax. Thanks to changes introduced in 2023, borrowing from Kenyan lenders has become more attractive, since interest paid to them is no longer limited. This makes local financing a smart first option before considering loans from outside the country. It's also crucial to keep proper documentation, especially if you're borrowing from related companies. The terms must be fair and in line with market standards, or the tax authorities could impose penalties. Additionally, make sure any dividends you pay come from profits that have already been taxed. Lastly, if you're involved in an affordable housing project approved by the government, you may qualify for special tax relief on interest. To benefit, it's important to apply for this approval early in the process. Fourth conclusion. In Kenya's dynamic tax landscape, real estate investors must weigh funding methods against compliance and profitability. Equity financing demands careful dividend management to avoid penalties, while debt financing offers deductions, but faces EBITDA caps and deemed interest rules. Legislative updates, such as the 2023 resident lender exemption and affordable housing incentives underscore the importance of adaptive strategies. By aligning funding choices with tax efficiencies, prioritizing local financing, and engaging tax professionals, investors can navigate complexities and maximize returns. Proactive tax planning is not just about compliance. It is a cornerstone of sustainable profitability in real estate.